Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, with occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Professor Art Sear of Carthage College and Robert Pape, author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base on State Street, that great street on Memorial Day weekend, 2005. We're in downtown Chicago and our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Wherever you're listening to this broadcast this Memorial Day weekend, we hope you're having a wonderful one with you or your family and your loved ones. And hopefully the weather is a little bit better than it is in Chicago today. It's kind of gloomy and overcast. But again, nice to have you with us for the next couple of hours on Beyond the Beltway. Tonight we're going to be talking about in depth about a subject that we unfortunately talk about too often on this program, and that is suicide terrorism. And if you think you know everything about terrorism, and you certainly know about the suicide terrorism, which has become a part of our lives in the world over the last 10 years, there's some eye-popping revelations that will come through the radio tonight. So stay right where you are. We have one of the world's foremost authorities on the subject of suicide terrorism with us. He is Robert Pape from the University of Chicago, and also our old friend Art Sear joins us as well. Gentlemen, thank you very much for sharing Memorial Day weekend with us. I'd like to begin by talking about getting your reaction to the announcement last week made by President Bush that he's pledging our $50 million of our dollars, U.S. dollars, in direct aid to the Palestinian Authority. President Mahmoud Abbas said during the White House talks that he's looking forward to this, that he thinks it's going to help ease the situation in his region. He thanked the president for his support and said Israeli-Palestinian violence was at its lowest level in 4 years. Of course, President Bush is also looking forward to Israel and their upcoming pullout of the settlements in Gaza. When you read a story like this, Art, $50 million, it's a lot of money, but it's not a huge amount of money. Do you think it can make any significant difference in continuing to ease tensions in that part of the world?
Yes, I do, in ways that go beyond the money, for two reasons. First of all, the leadership of the late Yasser Arafat, whatever his strengths, there were continuing long-term pervasive problems with corruption in the PLO, which may have been related to a significant degree to his own personal disorganization. He sort of did business out of his coat pockets. This shows that, from our point of view, standards are high enough for the organization to receive assistance. Also, this administration, and from my perspective at least, has been excessively friendly and accommodating to Israel, in some contrast to the first Bush administration, where his father and Secretary of State James Baker were able to, I think, serve more as an honest broker and keep our distance from Israel in ways that were effective.
Robert Pape also joins us. Robert, you're the expert on suicide terrorism. $50 million, does it buy any new friends in that region of the world that are less likely to strap on a belt?
Well, I agree with what Art said. I think that the $50 million in and of itself is a relatively small amount of money when you're dealing with 3.5 million people. But the reason it sends such a powerful signal is every year we give Israel $3 billion a year in combined economic and military aid, and we don't give the Palestinians anything on a routine basis. So the main reason this is so important is not really so much because of the amount. It's simply sending the signal that if, in fact, the Palestinians are forthcoming, there will be carrots at the end, and that may encourage still more forthcoming behavior.
Does this create a political problem for Abbas, though, in that he might be viewed as some sort of a puppet? Because he's still trying to, you know, secure his own, you know, future as the leader. Art, is that a problem?
He's got a lot of problems.
He comes to the White House, gets a photo op, and gets $50 million. A lot of presidents of foreign countries would like that, but does it create a problem for him?
I don't think so, compared to his other problems, the most important of which is establishing his own independent persona and credibility outside of the very large shadow of Yasser Arafat, and secondly, being viewed by his own people as someone who's not just a tool of the Israelis. I think those are much bigger problems for him than accepting money from Washington.
I want to shift now to a principal focus of tonight's broadcast, and that is the issue of suicide terrorism around the world. And I want to focus that really, we're talking about suicide terrorism, that unique element of terrorism that we have been reading so much about. And In your book, Dying to Win, Bob, it's described as paradigm shifting, and you come up with several new facts, or your take on facts, if I might say. And I want to get your I'm going to give you an opportunity to sort of elaborate on some of those. And one is, suicide terrorism is not primarily a product of Islamic fundamentalism, as I think most people have thought.
Many Americans have thought that suicide terrorism is largely due to religion, and specifically to Islamic fundamentalism. And since many Muslim suicide attackers have been Muslims, including those on 9/11, who've professed religious purposes, to some extent that's not surprising that Americans would come to that view. However, over the last 2 years, I've collected the first database of suicide terrorist attacks worldwide from 1980 to early 2004. This is data that hasn't been collected before, and this new information about the attacks and the attackers creates quite a new picture about what is and is not driving suicide terrorism.
What's the common denominator?
Well, the common denominator is not really religion. The central fact about suicide terrorism is that it's not driven so much by religion. In fact, the world leader in suicide terrorism is the Tamil Tigers, which is a Marxist-Leninist group. It's a completely secular group. It's a group in the Tamil regions of Sri Lanka, which draws its recruits from the Hindu families of that island. It's not even Muslim. Yet that group, the Tamil Tigers, has done more suicide terrorist attacks than has Hamas. The secular Tamil Tigers were the group that invented the famous suicide belt that we so commonly associate with Hamas. They invented it for a suicide attack when they assassinated Rajiv Gandhi in May 1991. Hamas got the idea of the suicide belt from the Tamil Tigers. What is the central common denominator of among the vast majority of suicide terrorist attacks, over 95%, is that they have a clear strategic objective to compel modern democracies to withdraw military forces from the territory that the terrorists view as their homeland, from Lebanon to the West Bank to Sri Lanka to Kashmir to Chechnya. All major suicide terrorist campaigns since 1980 have had as their central objective to compel a democratic state to withdraw from military control or occupation of the territory that the terrorists view as their homeland.
Art, as you look at suicide terrorism and bombers and what they've done over the last 10 years, are they winning? Are they winning? Are they getting their objective?
In and of themselves, I don't think so. I think insofar as Islamic fundamentalism is growing, it's due to other factors.
I want to get follow-up on that. We've also got callers on the line, 1-800-723-8289, talking about suicide terrorism tonight on Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us from coast to coast and border to border as we take America's political pulse every Sunday night.
The greatest economic giant the world has ever known.
An old enemy.
He's sending bioweapons to all corners of Russia.
A man is more dangerous than ever. A new hero.
You realize if this stuff gets out, there is no stopping it?
Patrick Swayze, Ben Cross, Michael York, Patrick Bergen, based on the best-selling novel. Frederick Forsyth's Icon. Premieres Monday night at 7, 6 Central, only on Hallmark Channel.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, we eliminate the middleman? Well, one thing's pretty certain, it wasn't the middleman. And how did they eliminate him? Something fishy there. But I digress. GEICO pioneered direct-to-consumer car insurance over 65 years ago, and they've been saving smart drivers money ever since. Give them a call, and you might ask them, what did they do with the middleman?
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
From Ventura, California to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. We are live on Memorial Day weekend, 2005. Thanks for joining us tonight. We have callers on the line as well. Let's head west to Bakersfield, California, where Richard is listening to us on KERN. Go ahead, Richard.
Well, thank you, and our hometown host is Inga Box, and he's number two, because you, Bruce, are number one of all radio shows, in my opinion. I'll get to my question now.
Well, thank you, Richard. They work together.
My question, gentlemen, general person, relates to the funding of terrorism. And I have heard reports, terrifying reports, that those guys who really want to kill us on the Afghani-Pakistani border, the really, really bad terrorists, who wouldn't hesitate on even killing themselves in the process, they have a massive supply of opium paste. Forget about the poppies that are growing up now. Some even growing from the dirt that overturned from our own bombs. Record poppies growing. Now, forget that. They have a virtually inexhaustible supply of money in poppy paste underground, perhaps even a two-year world supply. I request comment on that.
Richard, stand by. Let's let Robert tackle that one. Where does the money come from?
Well, I think the caller is right that there are some large sources of money. Opium is one of them in Afghanistan. But the important thing to point out about the money is just how little money is actually involved in a terrorist attack. One of the reasons why terrorist money, we talk about it so much, is precisely because just a little bit will go an awful long way. The funding for the entire 9/11 operation, now that we've had the 9/11 Commission look at this exhaustively, for all 19 hijackers, for all the time that they were involved in this, was less than $500,000. So you can see that with that, and that was a very large operation by these standards, so that you can see that if there are opportunities for terrorists to cream off just pennies or just small percentages off of large opium deals, in fact, that's more than enough money to fund it. And the main problem is not so much that there's opium being grown as much as that the terrorism is just so cheap.
Is there... Let's talk about the structure of terrorism, not specifically suicide terrorism, but the broader issue of terrorism. How structured is the communication and maybe even the exchange of dollars between terrorist organizations around the world?
It's less structured in a tight, centralized fashion than we sometimes discuss and sometimes like to believe. It is certainly true there's lots of linkages across terrorist groups, especially with operational learning. I just mentioned a moment ago that the Tigers invented the suicide vest, and then Hamas picked up on that right away. Well, in fact, it's common for groups to share operational information, that is, ideas. It's also common for them to train in with each other. There were, in the early 1980s...
Where do they train?
Well, they can train in any small remote location, but one of the things that's interesting with what I was about to say about Lebanon in the 1980s is that Hezbollah, which is a famous group in Lebanon, actually was brought in a few Tamil Tigers from Sri Lanka to train with its forces, not because the Tamil Tigers were ever going to do any kind of attack against Israel, but simply because it was an opportunity for the Tamil Tigers to get some experience. And one of the important things about Iraq today is I will not at all be surprised to find out that Iraq has become one of the world's premier training grounds for terrorists.
And the communication, given all the spy satellites that we have, how do they communicate?
You mean how do terrorists communicate with each other? They communicate in all kinds of, they send couriers to each other, they use cell phones. It's not possible for us to track, we siphon in a fantastic amount of information around the world on a daily basis. That's how powerful our technology is in collecting, but we can only translate and analyze a tiny fraction of that information. And one of the things that I talk with the DOD with all the time are ideas about how we can better use computers and our computer equipment to siphon through some of that information. And that's one of the problems, that's one of the ways in which it's just so difficult to track a handful of people talking to each other around the world.
Do all terrorist organizations have a suicide division?
No. In fact, terrorism, one of the things I was really struck to find, doing this book, I've had a lot of misconceptions about suicide terrorism as well. One of the things I thought is that I was going to discover that suicide terrorist groups are a lot like the Baader-Meinhof gang. That is, there are 20 people.
German-based.
The German-based group.
In the 70s.
Who were 15 or 20 really tightly committed individuals with the group for quite some time. And what I was thinking is they were kind of like a cult. That is, that they were just this tiny group who then just decided, like Waco or Heaven's Gate, just to go off and do suicide attacks. Turns out suicide terrorist groups don't come from that background at all. Suicide terrorist groups are typically an evolution from a large guerrilla-based insurgency where there are thousands and thousands of cadre, and that an original guerrilla insurgency has failed, and that has led terrorist leaders to push toward suicide attack as a better way to kill. That is, the purpose of the suicide attack for these groups is really not to commit suicide. It's not to die, although the individual is obviously willing to do that. The purpose of the suicide attack is to make an insurgency more deadly effective, to kill more members of the target audience.
Like a last resort?
No, I wish it was simply a last resort, because, in fact, that would mean that they're about to fizzle out and that they would die off and that we'd be just turning the corner, so to speak. Once we saw a wave of suicide attacks, everything was all going to be over. One of the problems we have with suicide terrorism, it tends to mount, it tends to accumulate, it tends to rise over time. So that what's happened in Iraq, for instance, over the last 2 years is a pattern that's all too common with suicide terrorism. It tends to emerge from an insurgency, it tends to emerge first in small numbers, and then it tends to grow and to grow and to grow.
All right, do you have a question?
Sure. I'm interested in the degree to which you think, kind of following Sam Huntington's argument about a clash of civilization and fundamentally different outlooks in the world, how much this can be related in broad terms to a Muslim or Asian worldview. Suicide attacks have been important parts of wars in the Pacific during World War II, very famously during the Vietnam War, the Viet Cong, and even the North Vietnamese would use suicide tactics as a way of achieving objectives, and especially during the Tet Offensive, when they penetrated the American embassy in Saigon to influence American public opinion. It's hard for me to find similar examples in Western warfare.
Well, the very first group to use the suicide tactics were actually the Jewish zealots in Zaqari. As I lay out the precursors to suicide terrorism in my book, and the very earliest group I can find who does suicide attack on a regular basis, that is a suicide mission, because obviously before the 19th century, there are no explosives to use. So we refer to suicide missions, what we mean is, in the case of the Jewish zealots, for instance, they were part of an insurgency. The group was trying to foment a rebellion to cause the Roman Empire to abandon its occupation. And what the zealots in Sicari did is they used knives to go and kill Roman soldiers, realizing that they would be immediately killed on the spot. And this would happen over and over and over again, and in fact fomented the great Jewish War of 66. I mean, this is the one of the main things leading up to that war.
Is it to some extent closely related to then the mindset of the assassin? I mean, I would assume that most assassins think they're going to get caught rather quickly.
Well, it's funny you use the term assassin, because the next group that is historically the largest in using suicide missions are the actual assassins. That is the Ismaili group in northern Iran in the 11th and 12th century, who were the Ashashins, where the word assassin comes from.
Excuse me, Bob, wasn't the cultural context so different then? I mean, you're talking about really ancient times from our point of view.
Well,
I was asking more about more contemporary developments.
Well, the groups that have used suicide terrorists, and suicide terrorism has only been around since 1980. That is, if we try to find a true example of groups who have, what I define as a suicide terrorist attack, is an attack in which the attacker kills himself or herself, that is, does it himself, in the course of killing others. If you define it in that classic sense, since 1980, it's only been around since 1980 in modern times. You can't go back to Vietnam, for instance, and Algeria, and I've had many graduate students try to find this for me, and I've done it myself. We can't find any good classic examples of that. Are there examples before 1980 of martyrdom, or examples of terrorist groups using martyrdom tactics outside of a actually a suicide mission where they try to kill others? The answer is there, yes. The IRA, hunger strikers, we had a series of 11 hunger strikers in the late 70s and early 80s who were clearly willing to die. The difference there wasn't that they weren't willing to die. The difference is they didn't kill others along with it. So the issue there was the absence of murder, not the willingness to commit suicide for the cause.
In the early 80s, the British government publicized, understandably, contacts between the IRA and Palestinian terrorist organizations. Do you think that was valid?
They could, but when I looked at the case, I don't see... I'm sure they trade... terrorists commonly trade weapons. I don't think they trade lives.
Mm-hmm. We have to pause. 1-800-723-8029. We're talking with Robert Pape, author of a new book called Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. He's the top expert in the world on the subject of suicide terrorism. He joins us tonight with Art Sear from Carthage College. 1-800-723-8029. Your calls when we roll on from Chicago.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Arley Ermey, United States Marine Corps. While our armed forces defend our freedom, their families shoulder household duties and emergencies alone. To help, the Veterans of Foreign Wars and Vermont American Brand Bits and Blades have created the Unmet Needs Program.
John Fergus here, the VFW National Commander. Please help us help our military families by visiting unmetneeds.com and by purchasing Vermont American Bits and Blades. A portion of every purchase goes to help.
Visit unmetneeds.com and buy Vermont American Brand Bits and Blades. Thank you and Semper Fi. Hoorah!
Dead.
Tyler, we've been over this three times. There'll be no adults at Ed's house Friday night. No party for you.
But the whole class is invited.
Making sure an adult's there isn't easy. But if you don't, your kid's more likely to do drugs.
You are so stubborn.
Well, now you know where you got it from.
Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Thank you.
from Shawnee, Kansas, where they're listening to us on KCMO, to Belmont, Massachusetts, where they're listening to us on WRKO out of Boston. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We're live. We're talking about suicide terrorism. We have the top guy in the world on the subject. Dying to Win is the title of the book. Robert Pape is the author. He is also a associate professor at the University of Chicago, and also he is the director of the Chicago Project on Suicide Terrorism. Art Sear also joins us. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College, and also author of a book called After the Cold War, American Foreign Policy in Europe and Asia. We have lots of callers on the line. Let's head to them right now. Let's go to Barb, listening to us in Palatine, Illinois, on WLS. Go ahead.
Just to say quickly, hoping that everybody remembers the meeting for this weekend and to give our thanks to all those who have served our country.
Yes, that is without question. I was going to make that reference later, but you are appropriate to make it now. That's right.
Okay. My question is, lest we be making the same mistake that former President Clinton and Madeleine Albright did by trusting, I believe it was giving the Chinese all of this information, et cetera, and then come to find out that they lied. They weren't being truthful. What kind of guarantees do we have that this money, that this $50 million that the president has pledged, that is going to be going for the welfare of the people, et cetera, as opposed to buying arms and just furthering this terrorism?
Art Sear, what can you tell us about how we keep track of money that we give away?
Well, through audits and accounting, believe it or not, when we give foreign aid, the government is under some legal requirement to make sure that the money is accounted for, and this will be a very interesting test. I would underscore the point that Bob Pape has made, that money is not a major factor in terrorism. At the same time, it's very true that Saddam Hussein was providing financial support to the families of suicide bombers, and that's an important reason why our Israeli allies were so anxious to get rid of Saddam Hussein. I don't think this money is going to make a big difference in terms of the level of terrorism in the world.
I was surprised to hear the small amount of money for the 9/11. I just kind of sat here and shook my head. But when is this accounting done? Is it done years later? I mean, even if it doesn't necessarily go for terrorism, if it doesn't get to the people who are so in need of help, and then if this accounting isn't done on a timely basis, then it's going to be years later, just like the UN debacle.
Well, it's important to keep in mind, ma'am, if you're talking about U.S. foreign aid, that the vast bulk of U.S. foreign aid money goes to U.S. companies that in turn use the money to implement development projects. But the money that we go send overseas technically actually mostly goes to U.S. firms.
Yeah. But this money is not. This money is going directly to the U.S.
Well, it's a good question. We'll see how effective the auditing is.
Well, that's true, and I trust you folks will report it. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
We report everything. Everything.
To follow up on what Barb had to say, we are on the eve of Memorial Day, the day each year when we think and take a moment, hopefully, to remember and reflect on those who, in service to the country and dedicated to this country, have gone and paid the ultimate price. And any time anybody, whether it's now a man or a woman, goes into the armed services, there is the possibility that they will be sent in harm's way and they will not come back. And we revere them. We honor them. We talk certainly a lot about those that have given their lives. Looking at the suicide terrorists, they too, in their mind, they're willing to die for a cause. They deliberately go out to die for a cause. We don't deliberately go out to die for a cause. But how are they revered in their respective communities? And what happens to them and their memories?
Well, they are heroes in their local communities. There are statues to suicide terrorists in their local communities. There are monuments. There are streets named after suicide terrorists. This is true not only among, and there are pamphlets and leaflets. There's graffiti that is done in honor of suicide terrorists. However, I'd like to say one thing right off the bat, which is that does not mean that we should think there's a moral equivalence between suicide terrorism and our military heroes. We have to remember that even as we explain suicide terrorism is still murder. That is, it's not only killing themselves, it's killing others. And the murder is of innocent people. Our heroes, say our Congressional Medal of Honor winners, There's no Congressional Medal of Honor winner I know of, and I'm sure this is true, who's ever been given that medal because they murdered innocents. So even though tonight we're going to explain suicide terrorism and we're going to be telling your audience some things that they're going to certainly find quite startling because of the facts, they're going to find some very interesting things in the data, we shouldn't go so far as to draw a moral equivalence because the fact remains suicide terrorism is the murder of innocents, not just the death of the individual.
But we are also tonight trying to find out, and I think every American since September 11th has been mulling this issue over, and that is, are we different from those people? And if we are, what separates us? You just made a case how we are separated from them insofar as how we view death and dying for a cause. But how do they, you talked about that they are heroes. There have also been numerous reports about, again, getting back to money, that the families of suicide bombers and terrorists, mm-hmm. they are rewarded. Where does that money come from?
Well,
and how much are they paid?
Reports started to emerge about 1998 or so, that Palestinian suicide bombers, the families of Palestinian suicide bombers, were being paid something like $10,000 in money that was collected either from the community or, as Art said, from a foreign source, say Saddam Hussein. Well, what happened immediately, that is within months of these first reports, is that the Israelis began a response where every time there was a suicide bombing, they would demolish the house of the family from the suicide bomber, and often the extended family of the suicide bomber. So it hasn't been, and they did that to over 462 homes, more, even though there were only about 120 suicide bombers. So in other words, they did this far more, they were certainly thorough, let's put it that way. So it's
But it didn't slow things down.
It didn't slow things down, and I think it has clearly been a net loss financially for the families of the suicide terrorists. So even though there continue to be, I would say, episodic reports of money going to the families of the terrorists, it's not even consistent. It's not the case that any family has ever come out as a net winner.
You mentioned that the suicide bomber or terrorist comes out of, in many cases, out of guerrilla or paramilitary organizations, not out of not out of religion. Is that 100%?
Well,
are there no instances where it is religious fanaticism that drives someone to strap on the belt?
I'm not saying that there are no religious fanatics. That's not quite right. And I'm not saying religion doesn't play any role. But the key thing is to notice that it's religion in the service of this broader strategic objective, which is to compel a democracy to withdraw military forces from the territory the terrorists view as their homeland. If you look at all suicide terrorist attacks from 1980 to the beginning of 2004, there are 315 that were actually completed, not attempts, the real thing actually done. 95%, 301, fit this pattern. About 5% do not. 5% truly are random, isolated events. That's not to say that among that 95%, some weren't also religious. The point is that it's not religion is the root cause. Religion, though, can sometimes be a useful recruiting tool in the service of the broader objective.
Let's go to Alan, listening to us on KLBJ in Austin, Texas. Go ahead, Alan.
Thanks, Bruce. Good program.
Thank you.
Two questions. One is, your guest has not mentioned the kamikazes mm-hmm. in World War II. I have an uncle who fought in the Pacific, and he said that if the Japanese had started their kamikaze attacks a year earlier, the war probably would have ended in a state because our losses were so horrific from Okinawa and so forth. Another question is, with Saddam Hussein, you know, he mentions that money is not that big a thing. Well, the problem with that argument is Saddam Hussein had billions of dollars, and he was able to buy all kinds of military equipment from North Korea, and I don't know what the... I mean, you need big money to buy nuclear weapons.
Alan, thank you so much for that question, because I do devote some time in the book to talking about the kamikazes, and you're exactly right, and your most listeners are going to be surprised to hear that you're right about how deadly effective kamikaze attacks were. And that's not only your opinion or my opinion, but there's a famous strategic bombing survey that Art knows very well. And when they analyzed the kamikaze attacks, they said that they were not only effective, but supremely practical under the circumstances. That is, they did not remotely attribute it to any sort of religious fanaticism. Why was that the case? Kamikaze attacks started in October 1944 as our aircraft carriers were getting closer and closer to some of the key islands, especially in the Philippines, that would actually determine the outcome of the war. Under those circumstances, especially because the Japanese Air Force was losing the ability to produce more and more aircraft and more pilots, the Japanese Air Force had to make a decision. Were they going to allow those carriers to come forth unimpeded, or would they try to sink them? They used kamikaze attacks to sink them, and they were 4 and 5 times more effective than ordinary attacks.
We have to pause on that note. 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about suicide terrorism tonight. The leading expert in the world is with us. If you've got a question for him, give us a call. 1-800-723-8029. Back shortly from Chicago.
I'm a reporter, and when a story breaks, I have to do my job, even when I'm congested from my worst allergies. Fortunately, I found Claritin D. Now, I'm Claritin Clear.
25 seconds, Tom.
Claritin D gives me non-drowsy, long-lasting relief from even my worst allergy symptoms, like congestion and sinus pressure. Nothing is stronger or faster than Claritin D. It takes on my worst symptoms and leaves me clear.
5 seconds.
Get tough on your toughest allergy symptoms. Live Claritin Clear.
Use as directed. Comparisons are among oral OTC allergy products.
If you're a horse owner, you should know that West Nile virus remains a deadly threat for virtually every horse in the U.S. Protect your champion with West Nile Innovator, the original West Nile virus vaccine. No West Nile vaccine has been proven more effective or protected more horses with more than 16 million doses safely administered coast to coast. Ask your veterinarian for West Nile Innovator today or visit equinewestnile.com from Fort Dodge Animal Health.
From Wilmington, North Carolina to Spokane, Washington, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. If you're listening to us on KXLY, we're heading your way. In mid-July, we'll be doing our show live from the City of Mansions, on KXLY. So stay tuned for specifics when we get closer to that date. Joining us around the table this week, we have Art Sear. He is a professor of the A.W. Clawson Professor.
Thanks, Bruce.
At Carthage College. That's in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He is author of the book, After the Cold War, American Foreign Policy, Europe and Asia. He is a regular visitor to our program. Robert Pape also joins us. He is author of the book, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. And I learned before the program that Art is somewhat of your mentor.
Yes, nearly, I guess it's 20 years ago now, possibly. Mm-hmm. Art was a professor of mine when he taught some classes at the University of Chicago. And he was a terrific professor and a great influence on me. And it's really a pleasure to be here with him tonight.
Now thanks, look what Bob. You did. Now he's the world's foremost expert on suicide bombers.
Yeah. I'll take as much credit as possible.
Let me digress, because I know you want to make
digress?
A comment.
You?
I know you want to make a comment about what happened in the last segment, but I just want to follow up on what he had to say. What's your reaction? I mean, here is someone who was a student in one of your classes, and, you know, I mean, professors have impact on students, hopefully a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean for you when you learn that one of your someone that was listening to you, actually, maybe you weren't listening to him, but we'll assume that he was listening to you.
Mm-hmm.
You've inspired this man, you've defined this man's life for the last
few
years.
Well, it's obviously it's music to my ears, and it's very satisfying, and we all change as we get older. If you're smart, you try to anyway, and I always taught a class here. As you know, I worked in nonprofit administration. Mm-hmm. As I got older, especially when my youngest child entered high school, I really decided it was time for me to do something different, so I started looking for more of a full-time teaching role. It's a way of, you know, leaving something behind. I hope to be around for a few more years, but mm-hmm. if you're sensible, you think about it, and if it's just a pile of money, or if it's just gratification of your own ego without doing something that's more human and humane, I think you're pretty unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just say a word about what made Art's class so helpful? Is that, well, of course everyone knows at the University of Chicago we're steeped in theory and we study the theoretical aspects. Well, we sometimes don't pay as much attention to the practical consequences of the theory, and Art, because he's so deeply interested in the real world, and you know, at the Chicago Council for years, and just so deeply, deeply interested in the real world, he's very, very interested in the connections between sort of general theory and the real world, and that was just an extremely helpful thing to be exposed to.
Now, you were going to challenge something that he, having said all those good things, you were going to challenge something he had to say.
No, I wasn't. I was going to supplement him and reinforce how much I appreciate the last caller in the current brief positive atmosphere you've created here, Bruce. World War II, we were dealing with a drastically different culture, and one of the most fearsome and worrisome things about the last year of the war, especially before the atomic bomb was actually implemented, before it was clear that it was going to work, was that our casualties were going up dramatically, especially in Okinawa and Iwo Jima. The Japanese were fighting harder and harder. Often armies, including the Wehrmacht at the end of World War II, will start to fall apart. But with the Japanese, it was the reverse. I was very sorry to hear President Bush kind of slap FDR posthumously in the face, and by implication Churchill, by bringing up Yalta on his trip to Europe, quite gratuitously in my view. Whatever the mistakes in retrospect of those statesmen, they got Stalin to commit to the Pacific War, and he entered on schedule. Yalta took place months before we knew we would have an atomic bomb in hand, and whatever Roosevelt's failings, he and Churchill were very mindful of the fact that it was going to be a horrific struggle to defeat Japan finally. I don't think we ever would have settled for a stalemate. The Americans, when you read the history at the time, we were absolutely determined to beat the Japanese, but it was awfully, awfully hard.
Let's go to Alan, listening to us on KCMO in Kansas City. Thanks for calling tonight, Alan.
You're welcome, gentlemen. Robert, you know, I've heard Al-Qaeda's aim is to bankrupt the U.S., and not militarily, but just to bankrupt us, and we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars over there. And I'm just wondering if this insurgency isn't turning into a holy war that's sort of like what the Russian-Afghan conflict was like, and is fighting radical Islamists a winnable deal over there?
Well, you're quite right that what's happened in Iraq is that this has given not only suicide terrorism, but Al-Qaeda a new lease on life. One of the things that I discuss in the book at some length is we actually have an Al-Qaeda planning document for how Al-Qaeda has planned to deal with the United States after Iraq. It was found by the Norwegian intelligence services. It was written in the fall of 2003, in September 2003. It's a 42-page document. It's in Arabic, and it's in it's a very detailed document. And what the document said was that once the United States went into Iraq, they should not, Al-Qaeda should not hit the United States again in the United States, at least in the short term. Instead, they should adopt a different strategy, which is to attack America's allies in the hopes of splitting America's allies away from the United States. And if they did that, then that would ultimately put more economic pressure on the United States. Well, in this document, they then went on to analyze whether they should hit pulp. Do I have time?
You know what? I'm going to hold off on that. Alan, stay. You want to stay on the line?
Sure.
We're going to pause for some news, but if you want to stand by, you have whetted the appetite at the end of hour number one talking about this. Now, I just want to clarify. This is a Norwegian intelligence document that was
captured. This is an actual Al-Qaeda document found on radical Islamic websites by Norwegian intelligence.
About what the role of Al-Qaeda will be.
No, about Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's actual strategy for how to deal with the United States, whether to attack it or not. This is new information you probably aren't familiar with.
Well, I would say that that's the perfect way to end 1 hour and keep everybody right where they are for hour number two. Boy, oh boy, talk about a tease. That's it. Al-Qaeda, their plan for the United States. That's coming up in the second hour of Beyond the Beltway. Art Sear is here. Robert Pape is here. He's author of a new book, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. We are going to talk about it in hour number two. We're also going to talk about why is it there has been no suicide terrorism in the United States since September 11th. I want to admit, maybe that's in that document. We will hear from it all when we roll on. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us back in about 7 minutes.
Here are two things you could do right now on Geico.com. One, you could see the gecko do the robot. Two, see how much you could save on your car insurance. And when you think about it, it's really a valuable use of your time. I mean, when was the last time you saw a gecko do the robot? Come to think of it, when was the last time your car insurance company actually saved you money? Geico.com. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
A Hallmark Channel original movie.
Russia will become the greatest economic giant the world has ever known.
An old enemy.
He's sending bioweapons to all corners of Russia.
The man is more dangerous than ever.
A new hero.
You realize that if this stuff gets out, there is no stopping it?
Patrick Swayze, Ben Cross, Michael York, Patrick Bergen, based on the best-selling novel. Frederick Forsyth, Icon. Premieres Monday night at 7, 6 Central, only on Hallmark Channel.
When you take 15 girls hiking, you've got to stay alert, even with bad allergies.
Hey, stay together!
Now I'm Claritin Clear, which means I'm in control of my allergies. Only Claritin is proven to make me as alert and focused as someone without allergies. Claritin gives me 24-hour non-drowsy relief from my worst symptoms like sneezing, runny nose, and itchy eyes. No cell phones in hiking. Stay focused. Live Claritin Clear.
Try Claritin Ready Tabs free. Go to Claritin.com. Use as directed.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Arlie Ermey, United States Marine Corps. While our armed forces defend our freedom, their families shoulder household duties and emergencies alone. To help, the veterans of foreign wars and Vermont American brand bits and blades have created the Unmet Needs Program.
John Fergus here, the VFW National Commander. Please help us help our military families by visiting unmetneeds.com and by purchasing Vermont American bits and blades. A portion of every purchase goes to help.
Visit unmetneeds.com and buy Vermont American brand bits and blades. Thank you and Semper Fi. Hoorah!
If you're a horse owner, you should know that West Nile virus remains a deadly threat for virtually every horse in the U.S. Protect your champion with West Nile Innovator, the original West Nile virus vaccine. No West Nile vaccine has been proven more effective or protected more horses with more than 16 million doses safely administered coast to coast. Ask your veterinarian for West Nile Innovator today or visit equinewestnile.com. From Fort Dodge Animal Health.
A party at Ed's house. Okay. Will Ed's parents be there? Then the answer is no.
Making sure an adult's there isn't easy.
No, his brother being there isn't the same.
But if you don't, Your kid's more likely to do drugs.
No, I don't care if he is old for his age.
Do it. It'll always be worth it. Parents, the anti-drug. To learn more, call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.